This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week we'll have some interesting fishing tales from a fisheries biologist still on the dinner table, some talk about food systems and food sovereignty. We'll have some news about empty seats on the bus, roaming dogs, staying off the roads while the plows are out, and where to go without heat and electricity during a storm. On the other side of the island, a group of concerned citizens is relieved after getting some news out of the provincial capital. Also on the show, we'll hear how a few cans of milk goes a very long way for some local families. These stories are coming up on the Coast. The Cape Breton Regional Municipality is looking into the cost of another garbage removal program. The Call to Haul project would have people calling 311 or the Solid Waste Department instead of waiting for an annual date for heavy garbage pickup. The Public Works Department would dispatch trucks to a neighborhood when a sufficient number of requests have been made for the service. Mayor Cecil Clark says the program enables residents to remove unwanted heavy items sooner rather than later.
Call to Haul is one of those elements of making sure that people aren't stockpiling, you know, heavy garbage. This is a way for them to have a scheduled pickup to do it over the course of a year.
Clark says they could operate it as a pilot program to see if the service will be successful.
If it works, great. Let's continue on it. If it doesn't, we've tried and we'll know the results of that, as we did with the divisional drop-off sites.
The municipality is sending out a request for proposals and the matter will be brought back to council at a future meeting. Also at council, officials discussed transit ridership and trends showing that fewer people are riding the buses these days. Public Works Director John Phelan says federal rules reducing international student enrollment at Cape Breton University is to blame.
First 6 months of this year, we've been down probably $250,000 out of a $600,000, I believe, ridership for CBU. We're taking a big look at that. We've had meetings with CBU recently. Their numbers for January are not good. And if anybody's been following the budget, there's further cuts to immigration for international students.
Phelan says, meanwhile, lower ridership does translate into some savings.
There's a middle of the road here somewhere between what we've saved in operating costs, because we're not doing a lot of overtime now. We're not running the heck out of our buses anymore. So there's a savings there that might translate into some, but that's something that's going to have to be discussed during budget.
Phelan says a new provincial program providing free bus passes to low-income residents could help increase ridership. Meanwhile, the Cape Breton Regional Municipality wants to buy some property around Centre 200 in Sydney. It's directing staff to buy two buildings, but no deals have been signed yet. Mayor Clark says the centre needs an upgrade.
A replacement of Centre 200 would be above $200 million versus what would be a refurbishment and rehabilitation of it. It's met the end of its life cycle usefully.
Clark says the community needs a flagship facility to draw people in.
We'll be welcoming the world's under 18 women's. We want more events like that, more curling. And to do that means we have to have a facility that is modernized. And those matters will be part of the budget process coming up as well.
He adds it's also part of a plan to set up a hub for buses and possibly a light rail service. And on the doorsteps of winter, Mayor Clark says curious people have caused problems in the past for snow removal and clearing during the winter. Clark hopes this winter it'll be less of a burden for the plow operators.
Really, in the height of a storm, it should be emergency personnel only and essential people out on the roads. And that is a hard message to try and ask people to adhere to, but it's one that is becoming more pertinent for us to be able to provide safe public service and winter operations.
Clark says it's difficult for some people to remain patient in waiting for the crews to finish their work.
Really, in the height of a storm, it should be emergency personnel only and essential people out on the roads. And that is a hard message to try and ask people to adhere to, but it's one that is becoming more and more pertinent for us to be able to provide safe public service and winter operations.
In other CBRM news, Councillor Steve Parsons is looking for a better way to keep some dogs in his District 7 under control. He said at a recent council meeting that some residents are complaining about roaming dogs, but there's some confusion about who should respond, the SPCA or the police.
It's an individual who's got three or four or five dogs at any given time. They're always going around the neighborhoods, causing, you know, getting in people's gardens and stuff. So I called the police because I'm getting from the resident, we called SPAs, but they're not going to come out anymore. So then I call the police and say, okay, what are we doing about this? Because I know they formally called and made a formal complaint, mm-hmm. right? But it seems like the dogs are still roaming, the dogs are still there, still an issue.
The SPCA's Kevin Struban told Parsons to call them, not the police, about roaming dogs, even up to 10 times if necessary. Meanwhile, he responds to District 12 Councillor Kim Shepherd-Campbell's question, what happens if there is a complaint on the weekend when the SPCA is closed?
A resident would call in, mm-hmm. and they would talk to Intercon, which is our answering service. Based on criteria, they would either send the call by email to be dealt with later, or they'd escalate it to an officer who's on call somewhere in the province. If the call needs it, for example, we had a call for fierce and dangerous, two fierce and dangerous dogs in Cape Breton. Dispatch officer called the officer in Cape Breton. We follow up with the complainant, and then if we need to visit, we go out and we visit. So in this case, we did.
And wrapping up City Hall news this week, more support is coming from people to weather the storm in the municipality. Three new comfort centers are on the way. Bruce McDonald of Emergency Management explains what's available during emergencies.
Municipal comfort centers are intended to allow individuals a place to charge devices, access internet or phone service, receive information from officials, warm up or cool off, and have light refreshments. Comfort centers are not intended to provide overnight accommodations, showers, or meals.
Councillor Gordon McDonald says accommodations have become more sophisticated since Fiona hit Cape Breton 3 years ago.
Things that I never once thought about is my thing was, come on, we need to open up a hall. And that's what everybody here was thinking, oh, we got to get a hall. But that's not the case when it comes to how emergency management need to discuss and how to be prepared in events like this.
MOUs will be signed to set up the Myra Seniors and Pensioners Centre in Marion Bridge, the Manitou Coastal Discovery Centre, and St. Margaret Parish Community Hall in Grand Myra South. Climate Change Task Force is putting on a series of discussions on food systems and food sovereignty in Sydney. Dialogue's Cora Perrigo speaks with Mal and Janet of the task force about what the terms mean and how they are connected to a larger conversation.
So what is food sovereignty?
What, layman's terms, or I think just average person terms like me, is about communities being able to have control over their food systems, you know, the distributors, the people who are consuming it, actually being able to make decisions about the policies and things that affect our food, and being able to make it something that's accessible and sustainable for everyone who's in the community.
As we look into this, there's a lot of things to think about. Understanding how does food production firstly work in Cape Breton? Who's producing food? How do they market that food? What are the systems like that affect how that food gets from the farmer to our mouths, right? And the different ways that that food gets to our mouths. And a lot of times we don't think about that, or we certainly don't understand how the systems work, right? For this first one, this is such a huge conversation. That's why I think Mal coined it the long conversation, because there's so many aspects to food. Food is it affects everyone, of course. It's like bottom line, right? When you look globally, you look locally, you know, we have people moving north who are starving in Africa and other lands that have no ability to grow their own food anymore. And we also realize, especially I think during COVID and that kind of thing, that how really, I guess, fragile it all is. Because if our causeway was closed, if we didn't have, okay, how would we feed ourselves? You know, so that we're really going to start with that kind of looking at. We have a couple of farmers coming in from different models who farm differently, and we'll get to hear from them. Plus, we'll hear some of the research, like what do we know about agriculture, its contribution to climate change? What are the, you know, the kind of risks? What are the things that we can do to mitigate or farm more effectively? And hear from people, too, what their experience is.
Yes, I think, really, when we look at things that are happening now, we have a government who is completely deprioritizing anything environmental in favor of industry. Mm-hmm. And that looks exciting on one end because you're like, oh, jobs, that could be good. But then when you look on the other end, you recognize that the way in which they're planning things out, the industries that they're hoping to introduce or revive in Nova Scotia are things that ultimately threaten our watersheds and our waterways. And they threaten our prime agricultural space. And they also threaten prime biodiverse space. And the thing you need to grow food is good soil. That's our agricultural space. Good water that's not poisoned, that's our watersheds, and we need biodiversity because that brings in pollinators, animals, and things that support the soil and support our actual land. So what they're doing really is threatening our food systems and our ability to keep building sovereign or independent food systems for Nova Scotians. And that's wild. And of course, we have lots of beautiful, wonderful environmental organizations who are coming up to stand up against this government, who are coming together to stand up for the needs of their communities from all over Mi'kma'ki right now, which is great. And we recognize that in order for us to organize, we need to do more than just have short comments on social media and short writing in a petition. I mean, petitions are great. They're a part of it. But we also need to be able to have long conversations with each other in community, actual conversations where we bring together different people's perspectives. Yeah. And I think something we're going to do with this series is, we're going to have a couple people come in who are lived experience experts. They live in the food systems. Mm-hmm. They know about them. We have Eric Levinth and Reed coming in to talk about, you know, how climate plays into food systems, but they're really just there to kind of root the conversation in here's some things we know to give us a foundation, and here's some things you might not have known. Mm-hmm. And then what it's really about is talking as a community, getting people who aren't part of it, their perspectives in as consumers, as people who eat food, God forbid, and to talk about how we can do things together to ensure safety and security for all of us as our futures change. And what could that look like for us as people in Unamagi and as Cape Bretoners?
And it's interesting when you were saying kind of the industries, these organizations want to come in and take over these environmental landscapes, I guess, how it kind of feeds into the conversation with Hunter's Mountain and what was going on in West Mabu. The argument that you always hear coming up against that is that we need development, we need jobs, but how would you, I guess, argue that position? You know, like you said, we also need food, and we need food that, like you said, if we need access to it, say if something happened to the causeway or something happened to our transport systems.
I want to tip back to Elder Albert Marshall on this, who also happens to be part of our climate change task force, which we're really grateful for. They always say we're not anti-development. It's about what kind of development we're doing and what we're building together. And we have our province is rich. We are so rich and abundant in so many things. But the way our government approaches this province is with old hat thinking that is not going to get us anywhere. And it's completely devoid of any creativity for how we could possibly develop our economy beyond sectors that no longer have a place here. Like uranium mining, for example.
You know, I think, you know, the bigger issue, of course, that we want people to think about is climate change. And we know that it's such a scary, overwhelming issue. You know, and let's face it, most people have kind of just turned off. It's just so big. And, you know, we know that. We know because we live ourselves and you want to turn it off. But we know also that the best way to have hope is to act and to come together with others and to be able to talk together and to understand and to learn and to build hope. And so that's, you know, what the conversation is about as well. Is we'll have some music and we'll have a little bit of poetry and we'll talk together. And hopefully we want people to leave feeling good. We don't want them to be scared off to come back again. And economy versus environment, jobs versus the environment is an old story, you know, and it's always thrown up as one or the other. But that story has got to stop because we know that that's just not possible anymore. We need to green our economy. And there are lots of places in the world that we can look for wonderful examples. And even in our own country and, you know, province where people have taken that upon themselves, or smaller industry, smaller, you know, and they are greening, right? So there's a willingness, if we would kind of support that, you know, mm-hmm. we could see that grow and we could look to the future in a different way. It's just unfortunate, as Mel says, that we're kind of, feels like we're almost pedaling backwards now. Mm-hmm. Why are we looking at this again? You know, why, you know, this seems not the direction we want to go in. But it is what it is, and so we will come together, and we will just have this opportunity to learn, to talk, to bring people from different, as we say, different ideas together. Right. You know, we certainly don't have all the answers, and we don't know everything there is to know about all these issues, so it's nice to have, we don't want anyone to feel scared off if they have a different opinion, that they can't come and share it. And, you know, that's really our goal as a climate change task force, is to engage, to provide information, to clarify, to work together, to act, and to build some hope.
Kind of on the topic of hope, it's so easy now. Like you said, it feels, you know, a lot of people are shut off to the idea of climate change being this inevitable thing, and there's all this kind of doomerism. Yeah. What would you say kind of to fight against that, you know, especially with the media being the way it is and everything kind of seeming like, hey, there's no end to, you know, there's no good end, I guess, to what is going on?
I really think that, you know, firstly, I want to acknowledge how hard it is not to be doomeristic, I guess, when it comes to climate change. Even just, you know, people who have worked in this space for many, many years are feeling really hella low light right now. And it's okay to feel that way. And I also recognize that, again, hope is born from action. And I look at all the wild things that we have done and created over our time as humans. And yes, some of those wild things have been massively destructive, but who's to say we can't do that in the opposite direction? Mm-hmm. We are really weird creatures who can do amazing things, especially when we sit down, have a second to take a breath and talk to each other. Mm-hmm. The stuff we come up with is incredible. And I really think we can do it in the opposite direction too. And even when we look at it, there's restoration, there's mitigation, there's adaptation. Even just those three, that's three different approaches. This isn't a one hit takes all situation. This is going to take every country doing something that works for them and their communities, that works for their environment. It's going to take different communities doing things that work for them and their communities. It's going to be a multifaceted, multi-person approach. And there's no one truth that's going to lead us through climate change. There's going to be a lot of them. And so when we start here in our in these conversations for Gathering Ground, our series starting on Sunday, it's about, all right, well, let's talk about this with our island. Mm-hmm. What's going to work for us? How do we do our part and pull our little piece of the sweater apart?
Mm-hmm. Because when you think of this island, if we're just thinking about the island right now, and I mean, the potential for this island is huge.
Enormous.
You know, we could be a green island. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd have far more economic benefit if we went down that road and said, let's be an example of a green island. Mm-hmm. That when we develop, we're going to develop green. We're going to, you know, try to grow food in a healthier way. We're going to have more food sovereignty. We're going to protect our coastline. We're going to avoid industry that's going to cause environmental damage. We're going to work with our First Nations people and closely with them and learn from them and use a two-eyed seeing approach. There's so much possibility, like you say, Mel. It really is right there for us. But, you know, of course we have governments, and we need our governments to support the kind of efforts that people are doing, because people are working everywhere trying to do this kind of thing. And so many people are. But so this is our local effort, along with other groups. But we kind of see ourselves as a little bit of an overarching group that tries to bring other groups as well together to network. You know, working along with those groups who are very specific, but yet their issues are very broad as well, because they're looking at things like coastal protection. Mm-hmm. We have no Coastal Protection Act in Nova Scotia, which is a crime. And there are, you know, so there's aspects, so many aspects to the climate change issue that we can impact when we come together and really speak.
Yeah, we really do. And I'm also thinking about how, you know, often the arguments from industry and from our government space is that, oh, if we don't do these things, we're going to be leaving people behind. And if you try and go green, you're really going to be leaving people behind. And that's it. No one wants to get left behind. Mm-hmm. No one wants to be without a job. No one wants to be able to like not be able to feed their families. No one wants to be able to left without shelter. But as we've seen, their approach, which is the same approach we've seen for decades, has been leaving people behind. This is where we get the job crunch. This is why we're so desperate for jobs in the first place. It's because their approach is not abundant for everyone. And it's especially not abundant for people who are, you know, riding the line of poverty and in poverty. And this island of people, yeah, we're not the richest folk on the island. We have a lot of mining history here. We have a lot of people who are blue collar workers. We don't want to leave them behind in the conversation about more creative ways that we can develop. We want to be able to support them through a transition, whether it's a job or educational transition. We also want to be able to use their skills. These are people who are highly skilled, very talented individuals. And that skill can transfer to way more than just digging a rock out of a ground. We can do so much more. They are more than just the muscles they take to do the work they do. And so they're all a part of this, and they're all welcome to come to these conversations and be a part of them as well. Recognizing that, yeah, we see you, we hear you, and we're going to make space for you.
This week on The Good Sentence, Paul McDougall talks to retired Cape Breton fisheries biologist Don McLean about his books, two new projects, and his favorite fishing places.
Don has been a fisheries biologist for many, many years in Nova Scotia. He's retired now, and during that time period, he's been, when you look at his resume, his writing resume, one could say he's a full-time writer as well. Just to give you some idea of what he's done, he's got three books already. Discovered Nova Scotia Sport Fishing, came out in 03. A Little Thing I Tied Myself, Stories of Atlantic Canada Fly Tires in 06. And his last book, and a fascinating, it's a look at the arts, crafts, and trades of Atlantic Canada called With These Hands. In addition, piles of newspaper columns, magazines. You may know him from the post from Tight Lines, A Fishing Story, all kinds of stuff. So, Don, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Paul. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you. I'd like to, just going through all the different things you've done, I'd like to just ask you about some of these, and then we'll get into your latest project, the book that you're working on. We'll leave that for a bit. Tell us about Atlantic Beef and Sheep Magazine and how somebody gets in that, and who's the readership for Atlantic Beef?
Well, I like to tell people, Paul, that I have the manure and sawdust beet pretty well covered in Nova Scotia, at least. Rural Delivery Magazine, which many people may be familiar with, is published out of Liverpool, and it's kind of a rural. It's been around for quite a few years, a long time, 40 years maybe, and they have spin-off magazines that deal with specific parts of the industry, and they have Beef and Sheep is one that deals with, as you would say, beef and sheep, the beef industry, the dairy industry. There's another one called Horse and Pony. There's another one called Atlantic Forestry, they might have another one or two there that I've missed. But yeah, so they're very niche magazines, but they have quite a wide reading within the industry. So I grew up in rural Cape Breton and grew up in the woods and on a farm and so on. So I have a real interest in that. So it was easy to I saw some opportunities to write about different segments of the industry. I took advantage of it. And actually, I think probably the first article I wrote was for Atlantic Beef. I wrote an article about the cattle on the Kippern Highlands. don't know if you ever heard, are you familiar that farmers in Margaree let their cows go for the summer?
Yeah.
And I was up there fishing, which we go up every year, and there was a sign saying a reward for cattle rustlers, and that sort of piqued my interest. So the story came out of that. So, and I've written about, actually just the last one I wrote was on the big, large timber building they're building in Membertou.
Okay.
The new government building there. What a fascinating place. Yeah. Timbers are absolutely enormous. So yeah, so I'm interested in that sort of aspect of a lot of things.
Yeah, fascinating. We were in Margaree for a night this summer, stayed at the Normaway, and Dave McDonald, the innkeeper, and everybody, pretty well everybody knows who Dave and his brother Jim are, but I don't know how many Highland cattle he's got there. And,
okay.
And he's got a huge property.
Yes.
So in the evening, there was like at least a dozen of them down by your fence, by the barn, where the music he has.
Okay.
And in the morning, I thought, I'm going to go up and take some pictures of the Highland cattle.
Yes.
Right? No cattle to be seen. So I asked him, where'd the cattle go? And he said, oh, my God, I got acres and acres and acres here. And they just go wherever they want to go.
Yeah, right?
That's quite interesting. Yes. So these type magazines, I know over the years because I love magazines. I think magazines are really great and they meant so many different types, as you say, and niche ones and that. But you'd often, if you go, went into a fairly big magazine shop or someone, that has dozens and dozens, you could see, a row, sort of in the bottom row or whatever of these kind of select topics.
Right.
In magazines, you often kind of wonder, well, who's actually reading these? So are these ones still all in print? You can actually hold it?
The rural delivery ones are still in publication, but a lot of the when I first started writing, I did a lot of writing on fly fishing and fly tying and natural history and that sort of thing. And at that time, there was probably three or four magazines between Newfoundland, New Brunswick, and Nova Scotia that dealt with hunting and fishing and outdoor activities, and they're all gone.
Yeah.
There's not one. So there's no market at all. There's lots of people, I guess, writing stuff on the internet, but hard to get paid for that. So it's that market is completely gone. But the other ones continue, hopefully for a little while, anyway. So.
Yeah, no, that's neat. one of the articles I believe it was in Atlantic Salmon Journal or one of these. You had a really neat quote from someone named Roderick Haig Brown, and he said, "A river is water in its loveliest form," and you were referencing Middle River, Cape Breton, and use that quote. Tell us about Middle River and salmon. And
sure. Well, Middle River is my favorite river on Cape Breton Island. I love it for fishing trout and in the fall for salmon. It's a beautiful little river and still, very healthy. In terms of the quality of the water and so on. Suffered this year, like every other river in Atlantic Canada, from the drought, but it remains a really unique spot. Actually had a book written about it many years ago. Peter the Sea Trout was written by a gentleman from North Sydney. He actually wrote a full book about the life of a trout in Middle River, and long out of print, but it's a really interesting read. So yeah, Middle River is a very favorite spot of mine for sure.
So tell us what's your favorite fish to fish?
I like brook trout. Brook trout is our native trout and our provincial fish and all that stuff. But I worked for 32 years for the province on sport fish management as a biologist. So and a lot of our work was directed towards brook trout. So it's it's our native, like I say, our native fish, and the vast majority of anglers fish for it, and it's good on the table, and it's it lives in wonderful environments, as Roderick Haig Brown said about river being water in its loveliest form. That you find them in some lovely spots, little lakes and rivers and streams. So had a lot of enjoyment from fishing for trout.
Is it all in the lure you use?
I mostly fly fish and I tie my own flies, so I get it. But I think you could catch them on a bare hook some days, right? So there's a saying that flies are tied to catch fishermen, not fish. So it's some little thing that catches somebody's eye. But yeah, the fish. They have to react fairly quickly if they're going to eat. So if they're in a stream and something floats by, they'll likely take a crack at it, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah.
So when it comes to fishing, then how much is skill and knowledge versus how much is patience?
Well, patience is a is a is a is a big part of it. And there's a, you know, a famous British writer that said, you know, study to be quiet was what he said when you're going to go fishing. You have to be quiet. Take a moment, look at what's going on with the river and the water, are there insects hatching and so on. But skill comes with time. And I used to say when I was working that angling or, you know, sport fishing is one of the few sports that you get better at with age, as you get patience and understanding and all mm-hmm. that stuff. So, every time you go out, you learn something new.
Let's switch over now to the, two books on fishing, earlier ones, and then you moved on to, I'll give the title again for our Coast listeners, With These Hands, Traditional Arts, Crafts, and Trades of Atlantic Canada. And there's dozens and dozens and dozens of people you featured in here that you tracked down and interviewed between 2016 and 2018. There's a bit of a narrative of your own story, and you're trying to, in some cases, differentiate between maybe what's craft and what's art. Mm-hmm. And there's one person who wrote a book on workmanship. David Pine, he said, craft was a word to start an argument with. Do you want to elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, exactly. I kept these words in my mind as I was interviewing people, because some people tend to look down their nose at craft as opposed to art or whatever. But it's there's a continuum there between, you know, what's craft and what's art, and even trade. Like, I interviewed some tradespeople in the book, and I would say, you know, that some of their work borders on art. So there's a continuum. If I discovered anything when I was writing the book, there's a continuum from craft to art, because I interviewed some artists in wood who do wood turning, and they have their work is in museums and on just art galleries and all that sort of stuff. But he said, you know, he's got to pay the rent. So at times he's turning out salt and pepper shakers, you know, and mm-hmm. so he said, you know, that he's doing craft. So it kind of runs the gamut, I guess. So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, they're all interesting, but one person was a gentleman, Ian Holt Jones, who just died in 2022. And some people may know him because he worked at Tom's Pizza in Bedeck for at least a dozen years. After he moved to Middle River, but he described himself as a bushcrafter, a maker of all kinds of things. Tell us a little bit about him and what you learned from
him. Sure, yeah, Ian was a great friend, and it was a huge loss to everyone and the craft community especially. But Ian came over here from Wales with his wife and just fell in love with Cape Breton and the wilderness and the, like you said, the bushcraft lifestyle. And he could make anything. Honest, you know, at when he passed away, they had a memorial service at the Hall in Middle River, and they had, I don't know, tables and tables of stuff that he had built, from clothes to moccasins to snowshoes to everything else. So knives, just a Renaissance man, because he made his own wood lathe and he made his own forge and everything else, and just got tremendous enjoyment from working with his hands and turning out this craft. He gifted me a willow creel for holding your fish that I cherish. Just a beautiful thing. So,
yeah, he has a picture of that in the book.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. He was a real artisan, but he was a person that got tremendous satisfaction from working with his hands and creating things.
One of the lines in the book, a quote from him, is "The beauty is in the use."
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Many, many other people you featured in there. David Stevens from Sydney. A lot of people know him because he's a major old car enthusiast, but he's an artist too. This was an interesting line, quotes from him you have. "As long as it's from your heart, it is all part of the creative process." And he goes on to say, "For some people, the perfect loaf of bread may be their aim."
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about David.
Well, David, an artist of the highest order, and as you mentioned, he created the money car, I think, that around North America with money on it, and a great guy and folk art, you know, one of the guys that I would say was in the first run, I guess, of folk art in Nova Scotia. I mean, I included a number, several folk artists in the book, but you know, somebody, one, you know, a legitimate folk artist said, "Well, anybody with a bandsaw can be a folk artist now." Mm-hmm. And they kind of break them up into two generations. The original first ones was from the heart, like Bill,
yeah,
or like
Sidney Howard, like David,
yeah, Sidney Howard. Yeah. That's another one. And you know, they created it from from the heart, and David is certainly one of those first class artists, no question about it.
Yeah, tell us just a bit about Nancy Oakley, the potter.
Well, Nancy's just, well, great talent, and she just turns out exquisite work. You know, combining ash and clay, and then firing them in a unique way to get the smoke effect and everything else. And and her work is on exhibit at the Kippen Center for Crafts and Designs, as it should be. So, yeah, and I think she's opened a gallery now in Escasoni. So, yeah, just first class talent.
Yeah. So. When you decided that you wanted to do this, and you say in the book that your father was a carpenter, he worked at Lewisburg, right?
That right, yeah. Dad worked as a carpenter at Lewisburg, good. My brother and I both grew up, you know, spending a lot of time working with him on wood and stuff, which I still really enjoy today. But my family, like many rural families on Kipreton, or any family on Kipreton, we were, you know, you made do or did without, basically. So everybody was fairly knacky. So that was a much admired trait, to be able to, you know, fix things, mm-hmm. and make things and that sort of thing. Right. So that's certainly something that, you know, created me to write this book, because I admire that trait in people, and everybody I wrote about in this book have that trait. They work with their hands, with often with few resources to create these lovely things. So yeah, so that's where the genesis of the book came from, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, and it's really interesting. It runs the full gamut of so many different things, including canoe making. Todd Labrador from Millbrook.
Yes, yeah, Todd Labrador, and I had good fortune of spending some time with Todd, and he and his daughter turn out these exquisite canoes in the traditional manner. Everything is traditional as it would have been done, you know, 1,000 years ago, I guess. So, from nature, and they're creating this very utilitarian but also beautiful object.
Yeah, and there's also there's larger interviews, and then there's smaller, big little, almost a vignette.
Yeah,
a little portrait like Darcy Hart.
Yep. Yeah,
I interviewed Parks Canada.
The summer I interviewed Darcy. He was building a chaloupe, I guess a traditional French kind of rowboat, down in the main part of Lewisburg. So I had a great conversation with Darcy. He'd been into boats all his life, and credited, you know, older gentlemen in the community for fostering his interest and giving him experience and so on. So not a big story, but it was an interesting part. And I ran into I did a count just recently. I have 22 people who are from Kipreton, or have roots to Kipreton, I guess, or came to Kipreton in the book. So, mm-hmm. And one of the guys who's in there, he's actually lived in Shelburne, Mike Hardigan, but he was born in Point Edward, and he makes wheels, like wagon wheels,
yes.
and he's built wheels for the guns in Lewisburg and that sort of mm-hmm. thing. So, yeah, you run into interesting people everywhere.
Yeah, it's truly fascinating. So. As Donna said, there's a lot of Cape Bretoners in the book, and it covers all of Atlantic Canada as well. And Don's got two new works in the works, books in the work. One is kind of a passion book, Fish Cape Breton, which is a longer project. But right now he's working on what he'd like to see get finished in the next while is a book called Capers Return and Island Journey. So why don't you tell us a bit about this, because you are looking for people to talk to about it.
That's exactly right, Paul. Yeah, my wife and we moved back to Cape Breton during COVID. It was in December of 20, I guess. And we're both from here, but we hadn't actually lived here for 42 years. And we were never far away. We lived in Newfoundland up on the mainland of Nova Scotia, but hadn't lived here for 42 years. So when we came home, I really wanted to write a book about rediscovering Cape Breton Island. And, it was a big part of my life growing up, and I was looking at it as an opportunity to rediscover it, because things have changed. I grew up, coal was king and steel was king, then it went through a long into a long decline, but I see, you know, I think things are really coming around the other way. So anyway, so that's the book is basically my working title is Capers Return an Island Journey, where I'm traveling around talking to people about who have lived here all their lives, to people who have chosen to live on Cape Breton, what they do, what their impressions of Cape Breton, and so on. It's a work in progress, as you mentioned, Paul, and I'm hoping to wind up the interviews in the next few months and then get into some serious writing. So
how many people are you hoping to get? Like, you probably have a minimum number, but no maximum.
Yeah, I'm pretty flexible. I'm probably looking at 50 or 60,000 words. That's what most of my books tend to run. So I got lots of room in there, I guess.
Yeah.
So, and anybody that's got an interesting story, I'd love to talk to them.
Do you want to give your
sure. Easiest way to get a hold of me is email. So my email, it's easy one to remember from my time in Newfoundland, is Old Trout, one word, OLDTROUT. And that's at seasidehighspeed.com. So
okay, oldtrout@seasidehighspeed.com. That's the talk to Don McLean. Okay, thanks, Don.
Thanks, Paul.
Cape Breton Man is reaching out to the community to help families struggling with basic needs. Mickey's Milk Drive is an annual event that collects canned and powdered milk, but this year is more challenging because of the cost of living. Mickey McNeil says grocery prices are affecting most people, even those who usually donate to the cause.
The prices have gone up and up and up, and where people would sometimes drop off a case of milk, they drop off a bag with five or six cans in it, which we appreciate every can. And it's just a sign of the times. Like, next year will probably be a little bit more difficult than this year. And we just keep pressing forward and hoping that some more people or a business or something will step up and even buy a pallet of milk. And We appreciate everything that everybody has done so far.
McNeil says they aren't complaining when it comes to people's generosity and what they choose to donate, but he says it could be easier money-wise to put the expensive brand names aside.
Try to buy. Milk is milk. I always say this to people that are going to buy milk, like not to take away from the brand name milk company, but their milk is usually quite expensive. The no-name brand, milk is milk, so if you can buy a case of that, you'll save some money and we still get good milk.
McNeil started the program a few years ago when he heard of a child using water for cereal. His efforts spread to collecting food, and a neighboring province, Prince Edward Island, famous for one particular vegetable, set up a deal with Mickey.
One firm would give us a free pallet if we bought a pallet. So we ended up having enough money to get buy two pallets, so we get two more free. So that's almost 1,000 10-pound bags of potatoes.
He tips his cap to a volunteer heading over to PEI to bring the goods back to Cape Breton.
Ryan McDonald from McDonald's Trucking there in Sydney is the gentleman that's going to send somebody over to pick up the load to take over here, and we greatly appreciate that. Like, I mean, everybody has been so helpful. It's known for Cape Bretoners to be that way. And like I said, we appreciate everything and that people have done for us, and we hope that we can achieve our goal.
Mickey's Milk Drive works in collaboration with a local food bank in Glace Bay, where staff is also noticing a drop in donations, likely due to higher grocery prices. Dialogue's Cora Perrigo has a report about the recently announced news of Capicolf development being called off at West Mabu Beach. She talks to spokesperson for a concerned group there, Nadine Hunt.
And how do you feel about the rejection, having it being, you know, the third attempt? It's pretty exhausting, to be quite honest, to have to deal with this from the same company 3 times in 8 years. But obviously, there was quite a bit of relief last Thursday when the government announced that they were going to squash the proposal. So yeah, there was a fair bit of relief, although I must say that the premier didn't sound terribly definitive in his statements afterwards. So there's still a little bit of anxiety, but obviously we are fairly relieved that the proposal was rejected.
And I know you had rallies that were held even after the proposal was rejected. What is the goal of the rallies going forward, since this proposal is, you know, as you said, even hesitantly rejected?
Yes, well, as you said, the rally was planned prior to that announcement last Thursday, and we felt it was important to continue to go ahead with that. You know, we had the support we had from people near and far was just amazing and heartwarming, to be quite honest. And we felt that it was also an opportunity for people to just come together and maybe, you know, celebrate that good news and to feed off the positive energy from everybody. I think it did that, but we also want to get the message out. And I think people are really receiving this message, not just here in Mabo area, but also across the province, that the Provincial Parks Act, as it stands now, is very inadequate, and it just does not provide the protection for these provincial parks that it should provide. You know, we just shortly after the minister made the statement that all protected areas are open for development, that was such a startling statement that the minister Maslin had made. And that got everybody, you know, that got everybody really aware of how vulnerable the Provincial Parks Act is and how vulnerable our protected areas are in the province. And, you know, for her to turn around within the same week and say and make an announcement about new provincial parks in the province, and also to say how important they were to nature and preservation. And I'm saying, is this the same person who just within the previous week said that all protected areas are open for development? Very, very mixed messages coming from the government. And so it's, you know, it's a concern when you don't know what the heck your government is going to do next.
Well, and even in the phrase protected areas are, you know, available for development, it seems like an oxymoron. What are they protected from then?
Well, that's exactly it. And that's, you know, that what's the point of calling something protected? Even the Provincial Parks Act now, as it stands, says, you know, they are protected in perpetuity. But it seems like the minister is interpreting that, well, they're protected for now until somebody comes along with what they think it's a better idea.
Mm.
We certainly don't think it's a better idea. It's ridiculous. So the Provincial Parks Act, which is one of the weakest acts that we have, that absolutely needs to be tightened up so that, I mean, you know, our community here has been through the ringer 3 times within 8 years. The same company that's based in Ontario, that's financially backed by billionaires from the U.S. And, you know, they have the audacity to come into our community 3 times and try to take this priceless little piece of protected park away from us. I mean, and then we have to endure months of anguish and anxiety and all kinds of stuff. It's just not right. And it's not right for our community. It's not right for people throughout the province of Nova Scotia who potentially, given Kim Maslin's statement that everything is open for development, you know, that's just not right, and we shouldn't have to go through this over and over and over again. I mean, I have a copy of a biologist's report from 2018. It was a biologist from the Department of Natural Resources, and he did some studies on West Mabo Beach Provincial Park. And, you know, the glowing references that he makes regarding the value, the ecological value of what's in that park, it's just wonderful to read it. You know, he talks about things like nationally, and I mean nationally unique kinds of karst topography. He talks about the sand dunes that are of high priority for conservation. And those are terms that he uses consistently throughout this report that I have in front of me. So, you know, how can you look at a report like that and then entertain the idea of literally gutting the park for something like a golf course? I mean, what we have down there now is what we call nature's resort. You know, you can't improve on what is down there. And as time goes on, we uncover and we discover more and more reasons why areas like that need to be protected. You know, 18 documented threatened and endangered species down there. And like this biologist said, you have nationally unique features, geology features. You have sand dune systems that are of high priority for conservation. The references are glowing. And so it just, why do we even have to entertain the thought that something like a golf course, as horribly invasive as that would be in this fragile environment, that should not even, you know, be entertained for 2 seconds. It's just not right. And it's not right that the community here, the people, have to speak up for the protection of this park. It's legislatively protected. It's the government's job to protect it. I read over the list of responsibilities for the Minister of Natural Resources, and those responsibilities are to protect and maintain our provincial park system. Her responsibilities are not to open them up for development. So why do the people of this community, and indeed of all of Nova Scotia, have to continuously validate the existence of these parks? It's just not right that we have to continuously do that.
I also learned that we don't even have a coastal protections in Nova Scotia, despite being an island.
That's right. I mean, this government promised to enact the Coastal Protection Act that all the parties in the province had agreed on. And this government, when they got in, they said that they would put it into legislation, and they failed to do that. And they not only failed to do that, but they dumped the responsibility of that onto the municipalities, who were totally unprepared for this. So, yeah, I mean, we call ourselves Nova Scotia's ocean playground, and yet we have very, very little public coastline available for our people. And this government has failed in its responsibility to guard guard that coastline. And so, you know, they're shrinking in their responsibilities, and they're using this whole idea that we have to promote development. Well, that's ridiculous. You know, the big attraction to Nova Scotia, the big attraction for Cape Breton, is their natural environment. And we have statistics to prove that. You know, the exit surveys that the Department of Tourism does, they ask people, why do you come here? And they come here because of our coastal scenery and our natural environment. And that's why we love living here as well. You know, these public parks belong to us. They don't belong to the premier for him to do with as he chooses. And they definitely do not belong to the Ontario-based and American financially-based corporations who just want to swoop in here and take from us something that we hold near and dear.
That's all for Dialogue this week. If you have an idea for an interview on the program, send us an email to news@coastalradio.ca. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.